To Down Not Out, a podcast about depression and anxiety with me, Paddy.
And me, Will.
That was quite a smooth start, wasn't it?
Wasn't too bad, actually. You threw me off course. I didn't think you were going to do that.
But what did you think I was going
to
do?
I thought you were going to stick to the formula.
There's no formula, Will.
There is a formula. You've done a protracted hello the first two times.
Yeah, one thing you do forget about me, Will, is I am wild.
Absolute wild card. Unpredictable.
How have you been? It's been quite a long time since our last episode. I know that our loyal fans have been not quite knowing what to do with themselves.
Chomping at the bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we've both been busy.
That's kind of true.
Kind of true.
You went skiing.
I went skiing. That is also true. So that wiped out a week. And yeah, our jobs as well. It's one of the busiest times, I think, ever in our profession. So
whatever, mate. Yeah. We've been absolutely useless. Cool. So what's been... So you've been skiing... Were you discussing the pod while skiing?
It was brought up in conversation a couple of times.
With the lads?
With the lads. The lads were like, you know, I've had a listen and I liked it. And oh, no.
That's so annoying when that keeps coming up. That was a sporkle quiz for milk.
Milk? What's milk?
Milk. It's like a white...
Oh, no. But,
well, okay. I don't know. It said sporkle and then there was a picture of pints of milk. I don't know if it's like how many different... Sporkles. Types of milk can you name?
Is Sporkle like a quiz website?
You don't know what Sporkle is?
No.
Yeah, so yeah, get a life, mate.
Get a life.
Yeah, get start procrastinating it. Properly.
Yeah, no, I just sit on Twitter.
Okay.
And just engage.
So what were the lads saying?
The lads were, yeah, I mean, fully supportive of it.
Polite bunch.
Yeah, very polite bunch. They wouldn't, they're not wanting to express their true feelings about something's quality.
Yeah. I don't want to play on your anxiety either, do they?
Exactly, you know, exactly. I'm making a podcast about anxiety. What do you think?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely not.
It just means that people just have to be kind to you.
People have to be kind to you. It's great. I mean, all these 5-star ratings we're getting.
I know. I'm actually not actually paying people that much for them.
Yeah, I know. It's getting, the rates are getting a lot cheaper.
Yeah, people just feel guilty, which is great.
It's Brexit marketplace, you know. But yeah, no, I had a lovely time away skiing. Saw some old friends that I haven't seen in a long time. Laughed a lot and come back feeling refreshed. Is the word I would use.
Live, laugh, love.
Exactamente, which is not French, not Spanish. Exactement. But yeah, lovely. And you, I hear, have been to a relevant talk.
Who told you this?
You told me this.
Correct. I went to a talk last night by someone called Randolph, although he refers to himself as Randy, which I have a huge amount of time for.
Yeah.
Randolph Nessie on the new science of anxiety, depression, and addictive behaviour.
The Holy Trifecta. That is some. That's some title.
El Tripod.
It
was highly, highly confusing.
Yeah.
Most of it went over my head, over my little head.
Yeah.
But it was very, very interesting. It was one of these how-to academy talks. Have you heard of these?
I've heard of them, yeah.
You'll grow into it.
Yeah.
You'll grow into this sort of stuff. Still young.
Yeah.
It was cool. It was interesting. As I say, it was pretty complex. I'm not going to try and relay it or synthesize it. Is that right?
Boil it down.
Not going to try and boil it down, Will.
Yeah.
But it was interesting. I mean, I'll give you a few of the takeaways for me.
You're going to boil it down, are you?
Not going to boil it down. I'm just going to give you a few takeaways. Looks like you've actually had a few takeaways as well while I've been away.
That is vicious. That is vicious.
Oh. So,
absolutely not any takeaways. I had a large steak.
Oh god, I actually cracked myself up.
Absolute weak spot.
Anxiety and depression is twice as common amongst women as amongst men around the world.
And that's something that I wouldn't have expected to hear. At all. Yeah. Because all we hear in this country, I think it's probably because of the highest suicide rates, you sort of hear that men have a big problem and men don't talk about it, etc. So I think maybe that the data might be skewed maybe by men not saying they feel that.
They have that's obviously being taken into consideration, okay, and their way of doing it is literally knocking on people's doors.
Oh well, okay.
So that has been accounted for in the data.
That's interesting, though.
Yeah, it's twice common, but I think part of the thing is that we know that. Well, I wouldn't have thought that women have it twice as much, but I guess it's two slightly different issues, isn't it? One is like the prevalence of it, and one is the fact that it is there with men, but they don't talk about it, which are actually, you know.
Yeah.
So I think we therefore think that it's more common amongst men because so many men don't talk about it, but actually twice as common amongst women. So that I found really, really interesting.
That is interesting.
The depression rates in Taiwan are a tenth of what they are in the US.
Wow.
Which, I don't know much about Taiwan, but that absolutely blew my mind.
Well, I do. No, I'm joking.
Not your best.
Yeah.
And if, so essentially, Randy was saying that if the US could get their depression rates down to the level of Taiwan, it would just, that's essentially,
it would change the country.
Yeah, I mean, he put it far more eloquently than me. He actually finished this sentence.
Okay.
So that blew my mind. Nice. And then really interestingly, some of the questions at the end were the question that probably stuck with me the most was, after all this really complex scientific stuff that he had talked about, someone just asked, well, how can I, what's your best tip for combating depression, low mood, all this sort of stuff? And having given this really complex scientific talk about the evolution of depression and all this sort of stuff, his advice was, see your friends, take exercise, and then he might have said, like, sleep and eat well. But it was that stuff that was just like, it's the same stuff. We all know it.
Boring, Randy. Tell us something new.
Tell us something new, Randy. So that was.
Tell
that.
Me to shove like 3 grams of vitamin C in my own day. Something weird.
Yeah.
You know. That was interesting.
Sleep on your left rather than on your right.
Yeah. The Taiwan thing is really interesting because Taiwan, as far as I'm aware, is a sort of fairly modern place. Like it's like everyone will have phones, for example. So then your standard argument that the West is the sort of technological revolution that's causing a lot of depression, that would throw that one out the window. You know, that's an interesting thing.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know. That's what struck me immediately when you said that. So I was like, Taiwan is not somewhere you think it's sort of, it doesn't have modern life's luxuries.
Yeah. He was also saying that he wanted some anthropologists to do a study on the hunter-gatherer tribes and look at their depression rates. Essentially asking the question, is modern life just not, are we not actually designed for modern life? Because if hunter-gatherers are all, none of them are suffering from depression, then that would be quite telling.
Well, I went to Kenya when I was a teenager, and we went, did on one of safari.
Ethnographic research was this?
Ethnographic research, yeah. Exactly. I was a very young professor of social anthropology. So our guide on the safari was this guy called Matthew, and I can't remember how we got into this conversation, but I was speaking to him about eating disorders, and he was literally incredulous, as you can imagine, because there are people that he knows personally who don't have enough to eat. Or there are people who he maybe knows in the next sort of village or whatever. His village, I think, was fairly well off in comparison to most. I would say, yeah, there are girls, mostly girls, but some boys in Britain who have enough to eat and deliberately starve themselves. And he found that, he almost found it funny. He was like, why?
Yeah.
He was literally like, why would they do that? And that's the sort of thing, I think, because his lifestyle is more so like what you were describing.
This hunter-gatherer, yeah.
Yeah, and he just could not understand why somebody with access to all that food would be unhappy and would want to deprive themselves of it. So that struck me.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Cool. Well, yeah. So that was it. It was an interesting talk.
Yeah. It sounds like it.
And I didn't sort of fully understand it, but that's the case with often these
things.
That's
the case with most of life.
That's the case with me. Yeah. I don't get it, but I just smile.
I fully understand this, but.
Cool. So we've got a new guest on.
We do.
Who we spoke to earlier this week.
Yeah, her name is Jean. She is 50 years old. She's from Slough.
Yeah.
And she's the first guest on this podcast who we don't personally know.
She's also the second guest on the podcast. So that's the second less guest, impressive. Than
less of an accolade, yeah. But still a big first for us. And she's somebody who we don't know. We don't know what she's going to say. We don't know.
Well, we have already done the interview. Oh, okay.
We didn't know what she's going to say. Yes, we didn't know what her experience was. And it's interesting. It's an interesting opportunity for us to see the perspective of somebody with mental health problems from a different generation to us. So yeah, we hope you enjoy our chat with Jean.
Yeah, we hope you do. She found us on Twitter.
She did indeed, yeah, she did indeed. And then sent us an email, our official email, which is donutoutpod@gmail.com, if anybody wants to get involved.
Please do get in touch.
Yeah.
We have, thank you for your ratings, who've given us ratings so far. We've got lots of 5-star ratings, it's very kind. We've got a few reviews as well. We'd quite like a few more reviews, please.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind a few more. My birthday's coming up in 3 months' time. So if you could just start getting the presents in early in the form of 5-star reviews or other star reviews, it's fine if you don't like it. But just please give us some constructive criticism.
Yeah, my birthday is either coming up or has just happened. I'm not quite sure if this depending has come
on,
out yet.
Depending on the editing speed.
My birthday's in mid-February.
Okay.
So hopefully, well, who knows? What date are we? Nobody knows.
But yeah, for Paddy's birthday, more pressingly, some reviews.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is us. This is our chat with Jean. We hope you enjoy it. Welcome, Jean. Thank you for coming on the podcast. You're the first person to come on the podcast that we didn't know previously. So that's a big achievement for us to sort of be casting the net out a little bit more. If you could just give us a brief sort of introduction to yourself, your experiences of mental health and why you felt you wanted to come and talk to us today, because it's something that, well, I don't know why anyone wanted to do it. but it's very nice of you that you have done. So yeah, short introduction.
It's good to be here. It's important for me really to kind of come and speak to you because I just want to get open about mental health. I was diagnosed with depression in 1991, following the death of my father. So when I saw Paddy's tweet, I just really jumped at the chance to come along today and just kind of talk about it, really, just so that people realise that they're not alone out there.
It's a miracle someone saw our tweet, is the first thing to say. So thank you.
Yeah, Twitter marketing is absolutely not our strong point. So that is an absolute miracle. I remember we were both so surprised when we got an email from somebody who we didn't know. We thought, wow, we've made it. So you say you were diagnosed in 1991, and that was, you were 22, you
That's
say
right,
then.
Yes.
Is it fair to say back then it was a different landscape in terms of mental health, in terms of the way people thought about it?
I think it probably was, although it could have just been the way that I see it back then. It certainly wasn't something that we ever spoke about in my family, but we were just not the kind of people that we shared our problems. My parents were brought up not to talk about anything. They were both born in the 1920s, and whatever your issue was, you had to bottle it inside. My mother actually lost a baby, left the baby at the hospital, went home, and the baby was never spoken about again. And I never found out I had a sister till I was 27 years old.
How did you find out?
Because my mum was getting older, I think she wanted to kind of release all of her past, as it were, before she passed on. So there was a lot of things that came out in later life that my brother and I weren't aware of, but went on for her. So I feel that mental health in my family has been going on for at least one generation that I'm aware of in my mother's side. So I kind of feel that you know, if she were alive today, then I would like to think she'd be more open, because it's a much more open society. I think technology has brought us all together a lot closer, you know, hence the fact me meeting you guys today.
Yeah.
Whatever your problem is, you can easily Google it at 3 o'clock in the morning, and a million people have been there before you, so you're not alone.
But it's quite dangerous. Yeah. Google is also can make you think you're perhaps slightly worse than you are.
Definitely, yeah.
So why do you think that your mum suffered from depression?
I think she had a very difficult childhood. She lost a sister. And coming from the background I grew up with my mum, I can only imagine that after her sister died from a collapsed lung at the age of 11, that her sister was probably never mentioned again within the family. Her own father was extremely religious. He forced her to go to church every Sunday, which she didn't want to go to, but she had no choice. So I can imagine that it was a very closed and not necessarily shown any love and compassion in that household. And I think, unfortunately, against her will, she brought that forward into her own adulthood. I know for a fact that she was a lot happier when she was evacuated during World War II than she ever was with her own parents. And she was one of the children who didn't actually want to go home when the war ended.
Where was she evacuated to?
Somerset. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, so she was a lot happier there.
And so fast forward to you and you saying that you were diagnosed age 21?
22.
Age 22 with depression. What led to that diagnosis?
Compacted with the death of my father. He had lung cancer for a year before he died, but we weren't told. We actually knew that my dad was going to die very quickly, 2 days before he actually died, so it was no time at all to come to terms with the fact he wasn't going to be around much longer, although obviously he deteriorated in front of us, so that was quite hard to watch. So being in our family, we just kind of buried him and never spoke his name again in the house. So it was just a case really of kind of sucking it up really and getting on with life.
I think it's interesting, there's some parallels between you and your mother, aren't there? Because her brother died.
Yes.
And your father died.
Yes.
And I think, is there a sort of theme of grief that was left undealt with?
Definitely. It took me a long time to come to terms with the death of my father, and I think it was mainly because we wasn't talking about it in the house. It wasn't until I met my husband, which would have been about 6 or 7 years later, that I realised actually other families deal with grief very, very differently. And they do actually speak about people that have died, and they still do keep photographs around and remember them on their birthdays and things like this. So it just opened up a whole new world to me, so that I was able to grieve for my dad in a completely different way. I mean, he's been gone 30 years this year, but you never stop missing them. It's just something that you come to terms with. But I think that in the UK we're particularly bad at dealing with bereavement.
Yeah.
I mean, where I was working, I was at the time, I was actually given 2 days off work, compassionate leave, one to organise the funeral for my dad and one to grieve. And the day that I was grieving, I wasn't paid for. So I think employers really need to kind of...
Yeah, and we're going to get onto this work thing. But I just have another question about... So your father and your family, did you not speak about it at all?
No. It seems really strange if you've come from a family that's very open and very compassionate. But in my family, we just didn't do that at all.
Was his name never even mentioned?
No. It's like he'd never existed.
Wow.
My mum was never one to keep photographs around anyway. And so there was nothing physically to look at. I'd bought him a ring when I started work for his birthday. And I've still got that ring today, but that felt like the only memento that I'd had of his life was that ring. So yeah, it's very strange if you're not used to that, but it's just how it was in my family. And I think looking back, my mum was brought up that way, so she didn't know any different. So, you know, it's just the way it came down through the generations.
You just mentioned there about the fact that you weren't paid for compassionately when your father has died, which is pretty shocking. I hope that's different now. I'm not sure if it is.
I don't think it is, actually. You don't think it is? No, my God. No, my husband had a very similar experience when he lost his mother, which was almost 20 years between me losing my dad and Bill losing his mum. And he was treated almost exactly the same by a different employer, and he had one day off paid, and the rest he had to take as annual leave.
What would you propose as a better system?
I think it's difficult because employers are running a business, but at the same time, you can't carry on as normal. Both my husband and I, we come from a council housing background. So if you're the last living person in the council house, not many people realise this, but certainly in my area, you're given 2 weeks to return the keys to the house because the house never belongs to you, you only rent it. So not only have you got to deal with the funeral and all everything that goes along with that, but you also have to clear the house and give the keys back to the council, which happened to my husband's mother. We had to deal with all of that with his employer saying, you have to take annual leave, I'm only giving you one day off to arrange the funeral, which is paid. So obviously all of that adds to your grief, so I think there does need to be compassion.
So you essentially had one day to grieve and to clear out an entire house.
Yes, yeah.
Wow. And you when you're grieving, and the last thing you want to be doing is removing the possessions of the person who's sadly gone.
Yeah.
But something that you mentioned to us before that we'd want to sort of touch on is you've always not ticked the mental health box on work application forms. I know me and you, Paddy, have had similar sort of dilemmas, but we've thought about it. I certainly have. I can't remember if you did or not. Just tell us why you don't do that.
In my head, whether this is reality today or not, I don't know, but in my head, I think there's still a stigma attached to mental health. I think Prince Harry has done a hell of a lot recently by speaking out about mental health. And I felt from my own experience, when you say one thing to one person, then it becomes much easier to talk about. But I think when you're filling in a job application, there's so much to be judged against. Why should you tick mental health when it's just another excuse not to be interviewed or to be offered a job? So I feel more comfortable just by not ticking it.
Who do you speak to about these issues, if anyone?
Just really at the moment, my journal. I'm just having that conversation with myself about how's your day going, how are you feeling. I've got to be very self-aware so that if, for example, I'm sitting on a train, I'll just stop and think, how am I feeling? And it's just that awareness, because some days if you're having a bad day with depression, it's almost getting through from 1 minute to the next minute, never mind seeing how it's going to go this evening, because I've got the whole day to get through yet. So I think you have to do it in bite-sized pieces, and if it is getting it down to minute-by-minute living, because that's where you've got to cope with it, I think that is... just something that you have to be kind to yourself with and just look at it in that way.
And what is your depression like? How does it manifest itself?
For me, a lot of it is in anger directed towards myself. I feel like there is an actual, although other people probably see me as myself as an adult, I actually see myself as a 3-year-old running around, not really knowing where I'm going, what I'm doing. So I get very angry at myself because I feel like I should know better at my age. So the only way I can cope with that is to see myself as a small child and talk to myself as if I'm talking to me, but and kind of saying, of course you don't know. We're not born being able to walk and being able to talk. We all have to learn these things. So coping with depression is just something you may have to learn as you go through life, and you have to find out what works for you because every individual is different.
So, at its worst, how bad has your depression got?
I've actually contemplated suicide. I actually had a pet rat at the vets. When I was much younger, I used to keep mice and rats, and they were the love of my life. And I had one that was in hospital having a lump removed from his leg, and the only reason that I didn't take the tablets that were actually in my hand at the time was because I thought my mother just won't go and pick up the rat from the vet because she hated rats. And I knew that he would just be abandoned. And I thank God that he was in the vets at the time, because I don't honestly know if I would have not gone through with it had that incentive been there for me, I think.
And almost 30 years on, how glad are you that you didn't?
I'm very glad now, because I'm one of these people that I just think if you just hold on, what could change tomorrow? And you'll never know that unless you see another tomorrow. And that thought is what keeps me going. And sometimes it can be, if you can just hold on for another hour, what could change in another hour?
Yeah, I think it always gets better somehow or another. What, if you don't mind me asking, what were the key things that sort of prevented you from taking that step, apart from obviously the rat being at the vet?
I think it was, for me, the fact of, I was just thinking to myself, what if it all changed tomorrow? What if you took your life today and it all changed tomorrow for the better? And then you've missed out on the rest of your life. So that was certainly a thought that was going through my mind.
And did you speak to anyone?
I spoke to the Samaritans and they told me to speak to my mum, which for me didn't help at all, because I had a difficult relationship with my mum throughout my life, which only really improved when I left home. So she was the last person that I wanted to speak to about anything, really, to be honest. So I remember crying myself to sleep that night, and I think I was just telling myself, just wait and see what tomorrow brings. You're going to be picking up your pet tomorrow. You'll feel better because the rat would be home with me, you know. And so that was the kind of process that was going through my head.
Did you speak to your mum in the end, or?
No.
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 If you don't mind me asking, did you ever speak to your mum?
No.
And your mum, you said, has died?
She has died since, yeah. So she died about 10 years ago. And as to the best of my knowledge, she knew nothing about my mental health problems, despite being signed off for 6 weeks at one point from work. I actually said to her I had a nasty throat infection that I had to go to the doctors for every 2 weeks, which was actually counselling.
Would you change anything about the way that you interacted with your mum, or didn't interact with your mum, regarding specifically your mental health?
To be honest, no, I wouldn't. I think it was because my relationship with her was so difficult, the reality was we didn't really talk about anything. So I would just say to her, I'm going out. She would have no idea where I'm going. There were no mobile phones back then. I mean, I was never one to stay out all night, but often when I'd go back home, she would be in bed, and to the best of my knowledge, she was asleep. So it was just normal for me then, because I didn't know any different. And it was only since meeting my husband that I've realised, oh, families are actually quite different from mine.
So meeting your husband and being with him, you've been with him for over 20 years now, you're saying, has that changed your, obviously it's going to have changed your life, but in terms of the mental health sphere, is he somebody that you can sort of turn to?
Definitely, yes. Yeah, I'm pretty sure I told him quite quickly about my mental health problems, and he's had problems in the past himself, so he completely related to me. And also, as soon as I met his family, which was quite soon on, they were so open in everything they spoke about that I just never thought, oh, your child actually talks to their parent about this subject, you know? So it was just such a different way of life. And I thought, I prefer your way of living and not mine. So that, for me, was what changed.
You, in the email that you wrote to us when we were going back and forth, you said this line, which I'm going to read out here, which is, we all touch one another's lives, even in very small ways. There was a bit more context around that, but would you mind explaining what you meant by that, please?
I think it's because, for example, if I'm walking down the street and I pass by a stranger, just for those 3 seconds, I'm passing them by. They're part of my life. Now, whether I've come to that on a conscious level or whether I've come to that on a subconscious level and recognised that, I don't know. But for example, if I were to walk past them and they were crying for whatever reason, I wouldn't be able to just carry on walking. I would have to stop and say, is everything okay with you? So, and I think sometimes the kindness of a stranger can go such a long way and we just don't even realise.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's cool. I've always found London to be incredibly strange place. I find big cities to be incredibly strange places because you don't have those interactions that you would have in a smaller town or in the countryside. I think that if I'm going for a walk at home and with where my parents live and I were to walk past someone, there's no way I would walk past them without saying hello or good afternoon or good morning. That's entirely normal. But in London, if you walk past someone in the street and you say good morning, they're going to think you're crazy.
Going to call the police.
Yeah. And I remember afterward, I mean, I'm going to make it sound like I've sort of like moved from small town farmer boy Paddy moves to the big city. That's obviously not the truth, obviously not the case. But I think that when I did first move here, I did try and say thank you on the bus or hello to people on the street. And then I was like, nah, this isn't working.
Thank you on the bus is a huge one. So I was at uni in Manchester and everyone to a man / woman.
And a woman.
To a person would say thank you as they got off the bus.
Yeah.
I haven't heard one person do it.
No, I do hear it in London, but it's very occasional. And when I do hear it, I'm like, bold.
Yeah. Mm. Wow. Out there with the politeness.
Yeah, exactly. So what do you feel about that? Do you think it's a shame or do you just think it's inevitable that in a big city this...
I think it's a shame that it goes on or doesn't go on. Because I just think you're losing an opportunity to make a connection. And if you don't connect with strangers, where do you find your friends from?
Yeah, well, which London is so bad for. Yeah. I honestly wonder if there's a place worse in the world than London for meeting new people. I mean, the general presumption is if someone comes and speaks to you in London, it's like, how dare they? How dare they do that? What nerve, what audacity they have to speak to me?
Yeah. Patrick Eccles-Williams.
Yeah, I know.
Jason Manford is a Northern comedian. He's quite a funny bit on that. If anyone's in the mood for a laugh, look that up.
Tell us what the bit is.
Okay, the bit is a little bit rude.
Gene, do you mind?
No, go ahead.
I'll go for it. He said I saw somebody reading a book that I fancied getting, and they were sitting on the tube, and I went up to him and said, oh, is that book all right? Have you enjoyed it? And he looked at me like I'd asked him to tickle his bollocks. a little bit rude. We might cut that out. I actually got my mum a book for Christmas called Lost Connections by a journalist called Johan or Johan Hari. And his big thing about the sort of modern day mental health epidemic is that we are losing our sense of community.
Yeah.
And that people don't connect anymore and you feel alone so much more.
Yeah.
And that is one of the main reasons he's proposing why mental health is becoming such a larger part of this country's sort of health problem.
Yeah, so let's look at that. Do you feel that you have a community where you live, Jean?
I do, because I'm lucky enough that when I moved in with my then boyfriend, he was born in the house that we now live in, and our neighbours have very rarely moved out, so we're all very close.
And where is it you live exactly?
We live in Slough.
In Slough, yeah.
Yeah. So we're quite lucky, but...
And what does your community consist of? How many people? Are they neighbours? Are they? How do you know them?
Neighbours, so they're neighbours. So that if we have problems, we know that we can go and knock on one another's door, which I'm told is quite unusual in this day and age.
Yeah.
I think it's sad that we're losing our sense of community. And again, I think that could be a generational thing. Certainly in my mother's day, you know, you could leave your front door open and your neighbours could pop in and out as if your house was their house.
Yeah.
And we don't tend to do that now. And I think it's quite sad, actually, that in our gardens, we tend to build 6-foot fences so we can't
actually
talk.
Depressing. It's incredibly depressing. I mean, depending on who your neighbours is, it might be entirely a good decision as well. Yeah. But
you've got some weird neighbours. Yeah. No, I think it's you're absolutely right to say that. I'm having sort of a gathering in a couple of weeks and we are making a point to put a note through the neighbour's door to say, please come, just because... Yeah. We want to meet some of them,
exactly.
And it is really, really sad, isn't it?
I think that's cool. I told myself 2 years ago when I moved in here that I was going to be best mates with Mr. Community, and 2 years on, I'm just like everybody else.
Yeah. Community watch or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you were part of your church, is that right?
Not anymore.
Okay.
No, we were part of the congregation, but then unfortunately with daily time pressures and modern living, it's something we go to when we can, but it's not a regular haunt anymore for us.
Was that an important part of your life?
It was, certainly when I lost a cousin, because I was struggling to deal with their death, I turned to the church. I'd lost my mum, my best friend, and my cousin within about 16 months.
Wow.
So the church for me was a very supportive time. So I turned to them because I didn't know really where else to go to. And just being in church gave me that kind of peace that I needed. And I was lucky that I had a chaplain to speak to that just went further down into answering my questions that I needed to be answered at that time.
I think that sort of links in quite well with the whole community thing, because I think our generation, we've sort of turned our back on religion, and there's sort of a more sort of rugged individualism to a society that you just get on with it, and religion is people sort of think it's not real or whatever, but it does give you that real sense of community and belonging to something.
Oh, totally. I mean, I think there's an absolute there's a liberal snobbery about religion. Usually. as though it's this evil kind of archaic. Anyone who's read a book and been educated couldn't be so stupid as to go to church. I mean, I think that it's incredible. I mean, I personally don't go regularly. My parents go regularly, and as I've grown up, I've increasingly realised, gone from thinking, "Wow, that's what an eccentric thing they do, how mad they are," to thinking, "Wow, what an eccentric thing they do, how amazing that is." I remember after when my best friends died when I was 17, I remember going to the church that weekend, and I mean, completely breaking down, but also feeling just amazingly welcomed and accepted. And it's without fail that I could not turn up to that church for 2 or 3 years and then turn up and be like welcomed with open arms. That it's so non-judgmental, such an amazing part of the community, the way that they visit the local old people, not necessarily old people, but often the people who are lonely are old. The part that the church plays, I find it amazing.
And you know, lastly, but certainly not least in my eyes, just some cracking tunes going on there as well.
Absolutely mega tunes. I've got a playlist on my iPhone of hymns, and I also quite like, as a few friends will know, getting back after a big night out and whacking on the hymns.
Yeah, it's that was one of the biggest treats of school, was just having a free concert once a week.
Yeah, mine was a free concert 7 days a week, so I got a little bit tiresome. Wow. Just to finish, so you were diagnosed in your early 20s and went through a particularly tricky stage at that time and you know, contemplated suicide in your mid-20s. What would, with the life that you've lived now and where you are now, sort of 25, 30 years on, what would you say to yourself back then, or someone else back then, knowing, with the knowledge that you have now?
Definitely talk to somebody. I think for me, I've definitely got to trust somebody for me to reach out. So that's difficult if you feel completely alone like I did at that time. I wish I discovered journaling earlier, for sure, because that's something that's really helping me at the moment. That's a very recent discovery. So even if you haven't got anybody else, you've got a notebook. So I think it's just a question of trying to reach out. And as a society, I think the more we speak about it, the more easier it becomes to speak about it, and the more we can see it in others, and we can just say to them, "Are you okay?" Because sometimes that is all you need to ask to open up those floodgates and get that kind of statement of what someone really is feeling out there.
Wow, well, I really, really enjoyed that. I hope that everyone listening at home did. What I found most interesting to talk about, and I have bored loads of people about this outside of the pod, is...
I want to do it inside the pod as well. Cover all base.
Is this whole idea of community?
Absolutely, yeah.
I am fascinated by it.
Yeah, it's so interesting, isn't it? I think it can go back to our hunter-gatherer point as well.
What's our hunter-gatherer point?
At the start of the podcast, we were talking about the talk you went to see, and he was saying about an anthropological study that should be done on hunter-gatherer societies because they have such a strong sense of community, or you would assume that they do.
Yeah.
That would play a major factor in the lack of depression in those societies.
Yeah.
Because there's such a strong community aspect. We don't really have a relationship with our neighbours anymore, or you know, we have friends, but our friends can be spread all over London if you live in London, or all over a big city if you live in a big city, especially in a big city. I think in small villages and small towns, it's less of a problem.
I think big cities are so tricky because you know, well, often, I mean, unless you've just moved from somewhere completely remote, you know lots of people, but how deep those relationships are, or like how often you see those people, it's like, it's really weird because you can like bump into these people the whole time, like, oh yeah, we should go for a drink, we should go for coffee, all that, and it's all really well meaning, well intentioned, but it's almost like it's overwhelming.
Yeah.
And it would be much easier if you just there was a rule that you would only hang out with people on your street. Maybe actually this could be an idea. Really, really shit idea.
Eccles Williams 2020.
Yeah.
Forced socialising.
Well, it just makes it easier, right? If you go to, if you live in a smaller town and every time, or a village, and every time you go to the pub, you see the same people, blah, blah. I understand that equally has its drawbacks. Everyone's like, oh God, it's the same people every time. So I get, it's a sort of grass is always greener situation, sure, isn't it? It's like, as soon as you've got that community, you just like, it feels really
strangling,
oppressive, and just like suffocating.
Yeah.
But when you don't have it, you're just like, you just feel like you're wandering aimlessly.
There's certainly a good middle ground, but I think
tell me what the middle ground is, Will.
God, well, you put me on the spot here.
No, you've
I've made the statement, so I should back it up. I think they're just somewhere in between the two.
No, well done. Yeah, I understand the idea of middle.
So when you do have the option, you know, you have. If you go to your local pub, you will see somebody you know, but maybe not to the extent where you live in a place where there's options, where you can easily get out of your community, so you can see something else. I think people often feel you get the you know like pop punk bands, like emo bands, kids are singing, I want to get out of this town, and that sort of thing. It's because they're sort of trapped in that community. They can't go anywhere out of it.
Trapped in their skinny jeans.
Exactly, trapped in the skinny jeans as well. But they maybe live in a small town in the middle of nowhere and they cannot leave. Where say you have a community in like Southwest London, you can say, I'm bored of this, I'm going to go and spend a day in Northeast London. That sort of thing, I think, a bit more accessible, more stuff to do that's not in your community. So you can go out, within 40 minutes, be somewhere for a day out and not be at risk of running into Brian, you know, because Brian's boring at the moment or whatever.
But I think that communities, even if we get frustrated by them, I think that when we look back, or when I'm sure studies have been done on this, that there is a link between happiness, quality of life, and having a community. And your community can be anything, by the way. Like, it doesn't have to be the people that live on your street. It could be...
Sure.
It could be... I mean, a lot get it through, like, to an you know, through your football team that you either, like, play for or support.
Yeah.
Through church, through the pub, through... I mean, increasingly now, the gym.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
But it's so interesting because people actually do look... are looking for these things...
Mm.
Perhaps not consciously, but joining these different tribes, which I guess would have been fulfilled traditionally in the past few hundred years anyway in the UK by the church, I'm guessing. So people's religiously going to these specific like gym classes and like swearing. I was chatting to my podiatrist. I say my podiatrist. I was chatting to a podiatrist the other day.
That I've seen once, so.
Have you seen him more than once?
Only once.
Yeah, well, yeah. If you've seen him again, then he is your podiatrist. He's my podiatrist, yeah.
And he was just talking about how everyone obsesses over like this particular type of gym training. They're doing like CrossFit or HIIT or spin, or and even within spin it'll be like particular types of, and he's like, it's all exercise essentially. Yes. It's just exercise, but people, it creates like an identity and a sense of belonging and a sense of like, oh no, this is my tribe, these are my guys and gals.
How would people feel superior if they couldn't go on forever about CrossFit or whatever, whatever it may be? No, you're actually right, having that identity is, I think, so innate that we sort of want it. We sort of want to identify with a community and a group of people, and that's why.
What community do you identify with, Will?
I don't know. You know, I don't know. I think a community of I'm in a group on a message group on Facebook about tennis, and we always like chat about the tennis world.
Really?
Yeah, genuinely.
I love that.
Genuinely, we used to.
Will knows a lot about tennis.
I know a fair bit.
So he's all right at playing.
Yeah, we used to like write for this sports website until it closed down. But then we just said, should we just keep the chat? And everyone was like, yeah, because I have no one else to speak to tennis, about tennis to. So yeah, there's that. What else do I feel a part of? I guess...
Work's a big thing. Work becomes people's identity now as well, which...
Yeah, work is a big thing. Politically, I do feel like in part of the community as well, so I do feel like I identify with, you know, the left wing of UK politics, and I feel that, especially on social media, I feel part of something with that.
Do you?
Yeah.
No comment.
Yeah, what about you, Paddy?
It's a good question. I think I certainly look for it. I definitely feel it with my football team, my sport, Ipswich Town. Oh, mate. And it's a good question. I actually don't know.
Lib Dems.
And then I guess through playing sport as well. But I don't. Yeah, I'm probably lacking it
right now because of your dodgy knee.
Well, that's definitely a factor. Yeah, I think. But also, just like I would like to have. I guess sport is a good one of these things. But
I mean, you are a star striker when you're a midfielder.
I'm a midfielder.
Are you really?
Yeah.
You were top scorer last season. Stop for the.
I wasn't for the whole season. Until halfway through, then I stopped talking about it.
Well, that's fair enough. You didn't actually talk about it. I did some investigative journalism and found this out.
Yeah, boy.
I went on your team's website and found it out. So are you CAM or?
It depends where the gaffer puts me.
Where the gaffer puts you. Mostly surging forward, or
I often am.
That's neat.
Depends.
Yeah, well, that's still.
Well, I can't work out which position I prefer. Anyway, this is very boring.
This is very off topic. I was interested. Yeah, no, I think we've essentially come to the conclusion that community is really important. That was one of our biggest takeaways from that from Gene, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you really have had a few takeaways, haven't you?
Right. Another one.
Another absolute belter. Right. That has been an absolute pleasure, Will.
Yeah. It was, I mean, apart from the couple of digs at my 4 pounds of weight gain on a holiday, what an absolutely lovely, lovely experience that was. We hope you enjoyed us chatting to Gene and Paddy, believe me. And we will see you in the fourth episode. Thank you for listening.
It's all right.